This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Affordable or workforce housing has been long at a premium, and as Charlotte continues to grow, the need is rising. Mayor Jennifer Roberts says we need an additional 34,000 units, double the number from just a few years ago. Rents are rising, wages stagnating, and other consumer costs have increased, so nearly 25,000 families already live in inadequate or cost-burdened housing conditions, barely making ends meet. That, in a nutshell, is the problem. Though we'll explore it further this hour, and we'll also look into some possible solutions. We're joined by Pamela Weidman, Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte and Housing Services Manager. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
And also with us, Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba, Research and Policy Director of Children's Health Watch, a nonpartisan network of pediatricians, public health researchers, and children's health and policy experts working to improve children's health in America. She joins us by phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Everybody has different income levels, so let's start with a definition of affordable in terms of what affordable housing is. Pamela, how much does it cost? Is that the right question to ask, or is the right question to ask how much of your income should it consume?
Mike, you're exactly right. It's about how much of your income should your housing consume. And general rule of thumb is that households should not be paying more than 30% of their annual income for housing.
And in Charlotte, how difficult is that for the average person, the working person, the person who, I don't know, waits tables, the person who is a nurse or a school teacher, a fireman, a police officer? How much of their income generally goes for housing in Charlotte?
So on average, any of those professions that you mentioned, Mike, the school teacher, the firefighter, the policeman, they are often paying more than 30% of their annual income for housing. Upwards, depending on the individual situation, folks are paying up to 60%, 70% of their annual income for housing based on where they choose to live. And people choose to live in different places for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, I threw out a couple of professions, but who are these people that are desperately in need of this housing? That we have, I just mentioned 25,000 in Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, living in inadequate or cost-burdened housing. And I guess that means cost-burdened housing means that you're spending too much of your income on the housing. But who are these people?
Yeah, these people are your school teachers. They're your firefighters. They're your baristas at Starbucks. They are your daycare workers, people whom you leave your children with every day. They are, you know, some of your x-ray techs. They are many people who work for the city and the county.
So I'm trying to really paint a clear picture of this, because a lot of people look at the people living in affordable housing or the need for affordable housing for people who are, and for lack of a better term, deadbeats. They don't work. They don't want to work. They've been on welfare for 100 years. That's not who we're talking about.
That's exactly right. The people that we're talking about, they are working families, working households. Just unfortunately, they don't work. Make enough, they don't earn enough to make the ends meet.
And it was recently revealed that Charlotte ranked dead last among the 50 largest cities in the country in terms of opportunities for upward mobility for the working poor. And it's hard to believe that a teacher would be in that category, but they are. Anyway, do we understand why we rank so low?
Well, there's a group that's combined by some folks from the Foundation for the Carolina. They've convened what's called the Opportunity Task Force, and they are studying that issue. And so they're supposed to come out with some actionable items here in over the next year or so. So they're working through that, trying to figure out what are all the factors that cause us to rank 50.
That's Pamela Weidman, who's Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services and Housing Services Manager for the City of Charlotte. We'll be talking in just a moment to Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba, who is with Children's Health Watch. And Laura Belcher joins us. She's President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Charlotte. They are putting together a seminar tomorrow at the CPCC from 5:45 to 7:30 called Affordable Housing Building Futures. Welcome to the program.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Habitat does lots of different things for working class people. They build houses. What other activities are you? You're involved in teaching people about financial management, and a couple of other things that you do besides just build houses. What are they?
Absolutely. So our core, our foundation is building homes, new homes. But in addition to that, we prepare the homeowners for their new home. And so we provide education and training, homeowner in progress training, so that they can learn about financial literacy, planning, and budgeting. But not just that. They really get the opportunity to learn about what it means to be a homeowner and to be a good neighbor and a community participant. But in addition to new homes, we also do critical home repair. And so this year we'll be working with mostly elderly folks that are in housing that has fallen into a substandard condition. And our goal is to repair the housing so that those folks can age in place and live there with a good quality of life. And so between the new homes and the new critical home repair, we're trying to advance both new affordable housing inventory and preserving the existing inventory that exists.
The lack of affordable housing presents all kinds of problems, and it's kind of a spider web. It's not just you're finding a place to put your head for the night. It impacts almost every aspect of a person's life and certainly every aspect of their children's lives. And that's when I want to bring Stephanie into this conversation. But before we do that, I want to play a clip from a video that Habitat has produced telling one person's story. This is Janet, not because she's a Habitat client, but because of her story and how housing impacts families and their ability to stay on track and to get ahead.
I am a single parent of two beautiful girls. Living in an apartment with limited income, it would go up, increase every year. And after a while, we would price out of the area. So we have to go find a cheaper place to live. And some places weren't great places to live, but you can only live where you can afford to pay the rent. Being a single parent is hard, it's very hard. But when we found out about Habitat and I was accepted into the program, I was, well, maybe this will help them to be better students, and maybe they can sleep good at night, and we don't have to worry about where we're going in a few months. And once we built our house and we moved in and they started to settle down, they changed and they blossomed and they grew and they got into schoolwork and learning was fun again and it wasn't so hard anymore.
So Janet just mentioned having to move frequently, and I could have played another clip of audio in which a person talked a lot about safety and about how they were concerned about living in the neighborhood. In fact, one night they couldn't even come home because there'd been a shooting in the neighborhood and the police had it all closed off. And that certainly is no way to live, to be afraid for your life in your own home. So are these outlier situations or are these common situations among people who find themselves in need of this type of housing, affordable housing?
Unfortunately, it's common. It's, well, way more common than I think we think. It's not necessarily visible from the street, and so you can't always see the substandard or overcrowded or unsafe housing. And so it's something that people live with every day behind closed walls and closed doors. And so it is a frequent occurrence, and it's what we, when we are working with our homeowners, really are trying to move them from that unsafe, unstable environment to one that's affordable and stable.
One thing, Stephanie, that came through loud and clear in that clip is the difference affordable housing and finding appropriate housing has made in the lives of Janet's children, who evidently blossomed once they realized, I'm in a stable situation here and in a safe house. One of your colleagues at your organization, Children's Health Watch, says that a safe, affordable home is a vaccine that protects children against the consequences of poverty. She believes that housing impacts children's physical and mental health. Talk about that. Expand on that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I think Laura was saying that it's a very hidden problem. I think that's the other piece of it. It's, you know, to the outside world, family may be appearing to be fine. They're going to work. Their kids are going to school. But the lack of affordable housing and lack of housing stability just spider webs into all facets of a person's life, and especially into children's health and mental health. Just the worry about where am I going to sleep, or, you know, are we going to be able to stay here? It's very hard to focus on learning, even as a toddler. I mean, or as a very young child, kids are very attuned to the stress in the household. And so if their parents are very stressed, worrying about bills, worrying about being able to pay, kids pick up on that, and, you know, parents less able to be the warm, interactive parent that they might otherwise be, because the stress is just so overwhelming. And that can play into their parents' health, and we know that if parents are unhealthy, their kids are more likely to be unhealthy. There can be housing quality issues that can provoke asthma or other, you know, lead exposure if you get into poor quality housing that maybe has lead paint still that hasn't been remediated. You know, and that can cause brain development issues. But just even apart from the housing quality issues or air quality or anything like that, just the stability itself, our own research through Children's Health Watch, we look at kids that are under the age of 4, and we've demonstrated that kids who are in families that are what we call housing insecure, so they're either doubled up or they're temporarily staying with another family or they're moving multiple times or they're behind on rent, those families are more likely to be struggling to afford food, which is, again, connected to a host of health and development problems for kids and for adults, that they're more likely to be in fair or poor health, that they're more likely to be at risk for developmental delays, they're more likely to be seriously underweight when they're very young. And so, you know, these are all things that follow kids forward. So
And in fact, your organization points out that kids who live in unstable environments that have to move 2 or 3 or 4 times because they're going to be evicted or they can't afford the rent, the rent goes up, they have to move to find another place. They have higher rates of obesity, type 2 diabetes, other chronic diseases. Do we understand why that would impact them that way?
Yeah, because, the family budget doesn't happen in isolation. So if you're struggling to pay for your rent, you're probably also struggling to pay for food. You're probably also struggling to pay for health care. You're probably also struggling to pay for your utilities. So all of those stresses add up to mean that kids aren't getting access to the health care they need. They aren't getting access to the food that they need for optimal growth. They aren't sort of having the regular, like I said, parental and other adult, you know, stable interactions. They might be too cold. They might be too hot. And, you know, all of those things can add up to putting them at risk of stress-related diseases, diet-related diseases like diabetes. And all if those things happening in early life have a long tail. They follow kids forward into adulthood, which is why we've talked about housing as a vaccine, because it's not just in the moment, getting stability for the family and improving health in the moment. But if you stabilize a kid early, that then tracks forward, and the trajectory changes. So, like the woman in the video was saying, like her kids could concentrate on school again. Learning was fun again. They could be kids again. They weren't worrying, and so that follows them forward. They're able to sort of move their trajectory up again and think forward, plan. You know.
Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba is a Research and Policy Director for Children's Health Watch. We also have Laura Belcher with us, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Charlotte, and Pamela Weidman, Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services and Housing Services Manager for the City of Charlotte. We'll come back with more of this conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Iron Yard, using tech-focused education to create growth and mentorship for people and their ideas. Enrollment available for 12-week courses dedicated to teaching code and more in Charlotte. Information at theironyard.com/Charlotte. Well, this is a city of trees. We have all these trees that line streets. They're very stately looking, and we have one of the best urban forests in the country. But like all things, our tree canopy is getting old. Trees planted a generation or two ago are nearing the end of their lifespans, and there are other issues facing our trees. Even though the canopy is decreasing in size because of growth and development, city leaders are out to expand it, and we will get an update on that effort when this program is on the air tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Next Monday, we'll be at Spirit Square's McGlowan Theater for a preview of the North Carolina primary. Get information about how you can be in the audience at WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Democratic candidates hold what may be a pivotal debate in Flint, Michigan, where they stand on the latest issues from job opportunity to foreign policy and how their positions have evolved.
Join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. I'm talking about the need for affordable housing, looking at the problem, and then later on we'll explore some possible solutions to all of this. Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba is Research and Policy Director for Children's Health Watch. She joins us by phone. Laura Belcher is here from Habitat, and Pamela Weidman, Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services for the City of Charlotte. Pamela, the mayor has said we need 34,000 additional housing units, which is double the number of, I think, just 5 years ago. Put that into perspective. Is Charlotte way under, I'm not sure the word, is our deficit extreme or is it average for a city of this size?
Well, Charlotte is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. So we definitely have a crisis, I'll say. But I want to be clear, when we say we need 34,000 units, that's right. That's
a big number.
That's a big number and a big difference. It's not about constructing 34,000 units. It's construction, but it's also preserving existing and looking at some of the existing multifamily housing that might be getting the affordable rents now, but making sure that they're safe and decent. So going back to Stephanie's earlier comments about making sure that the housing stock is adequate so that families and children can thrive. So we can talk later on about some of the strategies that the city is thinking about in terms of how to help us accomplish that. And Habitat is a great partner in that preservation.
So if we have 25,000 people living on the edge, which is what we essentially say when we're talking about people who are living in inadequate or cost-burdened housing conditions and they're barely making ends meet, what happens to those who don't have adequate access to this, who just simply can't afford anything? I mean, we have situations like that right now?
There are some situations like that, and unfortunately, we will never end homelessness, but mm-hmm. We do. There are some people living in shelters.
And they're not all they don't all have mental problems. There are people who simply can't afford it, given their income. Is that what you're telling me?
That is correct.
And the 34,000 additional units, is that because of people moving in to town or because more and more people are falling below the line where they can sustain themselves?
It's a combination of both. But as I said, Charlotte is one of the fastest growing cities in the country. So many people are coming to Charlotte because they do believe that it is a city of opportunity, a city where they can get jobs and do better for their families.
And what you're saying is not all of them will be successful at that, but they'll be here.
They will come.
All right. Let's talk about something else that you kind of alluded to, Stephanie, a minute ago, and that is the role, and this came up in Janet's comment from the Habitat video, the role that safe and stable housing plays in the lives of children. We have this tremendous performance gap in the schools among the haves and the have-nots. And a lot of people look at that and say, well, hey, we're giving these kids an equal shot. Everybody gets a free education, K through 12. If you misuse that, too bad for you. But what I'm hearing everybody at this table say is that is not what's going on. These kids can't succeed because the deck is stacked against them, and it begins with housing. Is that right?
Yes.
Stephanie?
Sorry, I wasn't sure if you were speaking to me. Yes, definitely.
Okay.
I think that is absolutely true. And I think just jumping back slightly in the conversation that's related to this is the other reason we talk about housing as a vaccine is because vaccines aren't just for the individual, they're for the community, right? So the more people who are vaccinated in a community, the more the whole community is protected. So if that one person gets infected, they have a much harder time passing that on to anybody else. So this is the same idea with housing. If we're all in affordable housing and we can pay our rent or we can pay our mortgage, that's good for the whole community, not just for me individually as a family, you know, or for my family. You know, and it's the same thing in schools. If I, my child is sitting next to a kid who's maybe moved a bunch of times in the year or is in a very unstable situation, it's very stressful at home because they're worrying about whether they're going to be able to stay in that that apartment or whatever it is, that trickles out to the other kids as well, and that makes it, maybe that kid's a little more disruptive, or maybe that kid's very distracted and the teacher has to spend extra time talking to that kid, helping that kid, and then gets less time teaching the whole class, or he's distracting the kid next to him. And it's not because he's a bad child or something. It's a bigger environmental problem. And so it's good for all of us when we provide housing and we're able to let kids focus on being in school, let them learn, and then my kid learns and your kid learns and everybody learns. It's better for the teachers. It's better for everyone.
I want to talk more about return on investment, because that's what you're talking about right here. But you work directly at Habitat with people for a long time before they actually get to build their own house and live in their own house. What stories do you hear from these people before and after about the impact of moving into something that is sound and safe and clean and all the things that Habitat provides?
Yeah, Mike, we hear recurring story after story of families that can talk completely about the change in trajectory of their lives before their home was safe and stable, and then after, and what it does for them for peace of mind, for their ability to keep their jobs and excel in their work. We just completed another round of homeowner surveys and found that 25% of our homeowners are going back to school within 2 years of getting their home, because they feel like after preparing for the home and doing those classes and the sweat equity that they invest before they purchase that home, all of that empowers them to want to move on and do more with their lives. And so not only are their kids then positioned for education, but the homeowners are too.
There was another Habitat video that I could have played a clip from, in which the person talked a lot about the classes that you put people through before they qualify to become Habitat homeowners, and they include financial management, learning how to live, first of all, learning how to set up a budget, and then learning how to stay within and live within that budget. And it occurred to me as I watched this yesterday that you don't learn that in school. I mean, even if you pay close attention, for the most part, you don't learn. I never got a class in that, never. Only reason I know anything about it was watching my father write checks every month to pay the bills and grumbling about it every time he put his name on the check. And I thought, this is important. I need to find out more about this. But a lot of people don't get exposure even to that.
Yeah. So our homeowners are invited to participate in a 15-week training class. And it involves financial literacy, like you were talking about. So how to set up a household budget, how to live within investing 30% of your income in your housing, and how to use the rest of the 70% for education and health care and those kinds of things. Also explains taxes and escrow and banking accounts and all the things that some of us take for granted, that if folks haven't had exposure to, that class really helps move them forward and prepares them for that.
One of the things that I realized yesterday as I was reading all this information, Pamela, is that this is not unlike the cycle of violence that we've talked so much about. Where if you are raised in an abusive household, you yourself may grow up to be an abuser. And if you are raised in a cycle of poverty where you have to move and everything is insecure and your education suffers because of it, you're likely to be that way as an adult. Is this something that policymakers have known for a long time? Are they beginning to understand this? Do we see this? Do people understand what the impact? First of all, is that an accurate statement? And secondly, do people understand, if it's an accurate statement, what that means to society at large?
Yeah, and you mentioned earlier, Mike, about the Opportunity Task Force and Charlotte ranking 50 out of 50 largest cities. And so that's been one of the beauties of the research, of the work that's come out of that, is we've seen that if you're born in poverty, you're very likely to remain in poverty, or it's harder for you to climb out of that cycle.
Hmm. Just because housing is affordable doesn't mean that it's safe or even fit for habitation in some cases. What is it that most of us would consider livable, safe? What is there a threshold? Is there a bottom line?
Well, I think what Habitat looks at is a couple of things as far as safe, and there, we look at, does the roof do what it's supposed to, and does the house not have leaks? Is the flooring secure and not sagging and at risk? We look at electrical systems to make sure that they're functioning and aren't a fire hazard. We look at plumbing and water, and is there water leaks and damage that then could be attracting bugs and leading to rot and mold and things like that. So we've got kind of a list of what we call the dirty dozen kind of things that we look at in existing affordable housing to make sure that it is not substandard.
Are there requirements? If I'm an owner of the housing that is quote-unquote affordable and not necessarily Section 8 housing, are there requirements? Do renters have recourse? Does the city say – does the city inspect?
Right. And so another one of my responsibilities is enforcing the city's minimum housing code standards. And so just as Laura mentioned, many of the things she mentioned, those are included in the minimum housing code standards. And so when we talk about from a city perspective, and if I take the liberty from a Habitat perspective, we not only talk about affordable housing, so making sure folks don't pay more than 30% of their annual income, but we talk about safe, decent, affordable housing. And so many of the affordable developers in the city of Charlotte, that's folks like the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Housing Partnership, that's folks like the Affordable Housing Group, Laurel Street Residential, the Charlotte Housing Authority, Habitat. Those are affordable developers who provide safe, decent, affordable housing.
Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of individuals, I would think, who own housing and maybe apartments, and they run them on their own as a business. Do you inspect them? Are residents, when they see problems, likely or experience problems, are they likely to report it to anybody? Because this may be, in fact, all they can afford. And if they cause trouble, they may no longer have that unit to live in. So are they likely to report?
Some do, Mike, and some don't. I mean, folks can call 311 if they suspect that there is a housing code violation, and that house, that property, will be inspected within 72 hours. And if there is a minimum housing code violation found, the property owner will be given an opportunity to correct it.
Habitat, I'm not sure how many Habitat homes have been built in Charlotte. I'm sure you can pull that right out of your hat there, Laura.
We've served over 1,500 families.
Okay. So, and you're in the business of one of your primary businesses is to help people get into home ownership, to help them. And there's sweat equity involved. They have
Absolutely.
To help build other people's houses first and help build their own as well. But why the focus on home ownership? If the need for affordable housing is so great, and if we really do need 34,000 additional units very quickly, why not be building multifamily units? Why build individual homes?
I think that the solution is multifaceted, and so we need both. We need multi-unit. We need the things that the Charlotte Housing Partnership and Housing Authority is doing, but we also need to provide opportunities and a pathway to home ownership. We know that one of the mechanisms to try and help break the cycle of poverty, to work on that upward mobility, is the ability to grow equity in a home, and that a lot of folks have indicated that coming out of the Great Recession, we look at the economy and a lot of the metrics say that we have recovered. But that's really true if you had one of two things, if you had a 401k or a mortgage, and to be able to build that home equity. And so folks, you know, can't really grow that financial independence without that opportunity for home equity.
So you're seeing home equity as a piggy bank.
We are. We're seeing it as something
as an investment that grows over time.
Absolutely.
It's a wealth builder over time.
Yes.
Okay. As opposed to renting. How successful have you been? Can you quantify how successful Habitat has been in terms of lifting people out of dire circumstances and into stability that has some long-lasting effect on them and their families?
Yeah, a lot of it is the stories that we hear and the way that we can put a face on these stories. So we have a homeowner that called us a couple months ago and wanted to thank and acknowledge their living in their home because their son had just completed his law degree and passed the bar. And he was trying to think about who to celebrate that information with. And so he called Habitat to say, this couldn't have happened without our home. And he also has a child that's an engineer. So in one generation, he's gone from a Habitat homeowner to a child that's an attorney and an engineer. And we have those kinds of stories all the time of the way that the family has progressed and the children have thrived.
Do those stories get out? Stephanie, this may not be a good question for you, but you can tell me if it's not. Do these stories get out? Do people understand this in the public at large, that what a role this stability of housing plays in raising the standard of living, not just for the individual in the stability, the stable housing, but for the city as a whole, for a city as a whole.
You know, that's it's something that we're working a lot on with a lot of different partners at both the state and national level. I think where it is beginning to get out is in the healthcare world. I think the healthcare world is really beginning to deeply understand how interconnected healthcare and housing are, and there's a lot of interesting work happening all around the country with healthcare systems and hospitals and various partnerships of trying to help provide housing for some of the most unstable people who have maybe really lots of health needs. They're so-called high users, costing the system a lot because and one really big piece of the solution is housing and getting them stably housed.
Well, healthcare costs in this country continue to be among the highest in the world, yet we rank 26th in life expectancy and 31st in infant mortality. And with regard to healthcare and healthcare costs, your organization, Children's Health Watch, has suggested that we could save some of our healthcare expenses by shifting them to social services and affordable housing. Any idea of how much money we could save or how quickly we could see a lowering of healthcare costs as a result? Because as you point out, a lot of people in substandard housing have major healthcare costs, long-term healthcare costs.
Exacerbated by the instability and the poor quality housing that they might be in. Yeah, I think there's a lot of very interesting work looking at the cost savings. There was one study, I mean, this is a very extreme group, but the cost study in Los Angeles looking at moving chronically homeless adults into stable supportive housing, and they found savings of $2,500 per month per person, so that's a lot of money. A more recent study that happened in Oregon, they found, and this actually was one of the more interesting ones from my perspective because it also included families with children. A lot of the work has been with single adults, which obviously we care about single adults, but being a children's health organization, I'm interested in studies that look at families with children. So this pilot out in Oregon was looking at providing supportive housing for a wide variety of populations, including families with children. And they found that after the people moved into affordable housing, Medicaid costs dropped by $48 per resident per month, which was almost $1 million savings over a year.
So
if you multiply that out by many, many people, that's a lot of savings. We can look at it.
So Pamela Weidman, does healthcare play a role, or does the healthcare industry play a role in pushing or advocating for affordable housing? Do we have people at Novant or at Carolina's Medical Center pushing for this?
We don't currently have an aggressive push from Novant or Carolina's Healthcare. I will say to you that there is a group. It's called the Housing Advisory Board of Charlotte-Mecklenburg, and that group is appointed by the city, the county, governing bodies, and there is a representative from the healthcare industry on that board. I would also say that Dr. Ophelia Garman-Brown from Novant, she is one of the co-chairs of the Opportunity Task Force, and they are looking at the importance of affordable housing. So they're beginning to get in the game, but I hope that we will see more of that.
Pamela Weidman is with us. She is the Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services and the Housing Services Manager for the City of Charlotte. Laura Belcher, President and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Charlotte. And Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba, Research and Policy Director for Children's Health Watch. We're going to come back and talk about how we get to build more affordable housing units. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and UNC-TV's Festival 2016, presenting the Forever Wisdom of Dr. Wayne Dyer tonight at 8. Information at unctv.org. The Democratic candidates hold what could be a pivotal debate in Flint, Michigan. How they fared, where they stand on the latest issues, and how their positions have evolved, the topic of the conversation, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to continue with our program about affordable housing. If you have something you'd like to say or questions you'd like to ask, you can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae, through Facebook at WFAE, or at Charlotte Talks on Twitter. And we are coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
Pues bienvenido.
Gracias.
These women are part of a large group of Cubans who are getting here by way of South and Central America.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Until now, Governor Pat McCrory and NCDOT have defended the I-77 project, but the Texas news brought a shift in tone.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing and the need for affordable housing. The mayor says we need 34,000 additional units. That's double the number from just a couple of years ago. 25,000 people, families, I should say, already live in inadequate or cost-burdened housing conditions. And we're talking about all this with Laura Belcher from Habitat, Pamela Weidman from the city, and Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba, who is Research and Policy Director for Children's Health Watch. And Children's Health Watch is a nonpartisan research and policy network of pediatricians and public health researchers and children's health and policy experts working to improve children's health in America. She will be here tomorrow for a seminar at CPCC from 5:45 to 7:30 called Affordable Housing, Building Futures. And Pamela will be moderating that discussion, as a matter of fact. Let me tell you what's been coming in as we've been talking from listeners who have been tweeting and emailing and Facebooking us. Tom tweets, one excellent strategy is including stable, safe housing in mixed-income, walkable, connected neighborhoods. A Levine Museum quote from a recent discussion, embrace the village approach, the know-your-neighbor concept, a town within a town. I want to talk about that because we've had some success with mixed housing right here in, I think, First Ward in Charlotte. That works, but a lot of people take a not-in-my-backyard approach, which we'll also talk about. Christina on Facebook, how about we stop selling out our city to developers and moneyed interests and vote in elected officials who care more about our city than their big campaign contributors? That would be a nice start. I'm not sure that that is a fair comment, but we certainly do have developers who have not been taking advantage of incentives already in place, evidently, in the city. And we talked about this on a previous program. We have, and I'm not sure the name of it, but we have this incentive program to include a certain amount of affordable housing in new development. And at last report, not one single developer has taken advantage of those incentives. Pamela, why not?
You know, it's interesting, Mike. You're right. When we were here before, at that time, no one had actually taken advantage of what's called the voluntary mixed-income housing mm-hmm. program. And essentially, a developer could get a density bonus, which would allow them to build more units if they agreed to include a certain portion of affordable workforce units in their development. Since that time, I'm happy to report that we have had two developers to voluntarily do that on their own without any density bonus.
Who are they?
Senco is one of the developers. They're redeveloping the Colony out at South Park. Mm-hmm. They agreed to do it. And then most recently, the developer's name escapes me, but he agreed to do it as well. So we do have two developers who've agreed to do that most recently.
And what was their motivation when other developers have either ignored you or turned the other cheek?
So quite frankly, they were going through a rezoning process, and they agreed to do it as a part of their rezoning.
So rezoning is a key. The city has to put some meat behind their desires or some restrictions behind. We use a carrot approach. Should we be using a stick approach?
I will say that the city of Charlotte, we do not have mandatory inclusionary housing. Again,
Does state law allow that?
We do not have state enabling legislation that allows us to do that. I will say that cities who do have a mandatory inclusionary housing policy, they have really moved the needle on solving the issue of the need for affordable and workforce housing.
Has there been any discussion about going to the state and saying, look, we're the fastest growing city in America, we need affordable housing, we've tried the carrot approach, it doesn't work, we need to be able to enact some regulations at the city level to make this happen? Any discussion about that happening between the city and the legislature, or is that just a dead deal going forward, period?
I won't say it's a dead deal, but there's no specific plans underway now to go to the legislature to request that.
So what tools do we have to get developers to develop these mixed use, where we have affordable housing units mixed in with other new housing units going up. Anything?
Well, where we've been really successful, so you mentioned earlier First Ward, that came through a HOPE 6 grant that we got from the federal government. So that is part of a HOPE 6 grant. So we have our most recent one is the Renaissance, is the old Boulevard Homes redevelopment. And so that is our newest mixed income community in the city of Charlotte.
Is it a difficult sell both for the to convince the developer to do this? Because obviously if you're a developer, you're in the business to make money. And you can't, I would think, not make the same amount of money. The margins are different on building an affordable unit versus a luxury unit. Is it a difficult sell? Do you get them to do that? First of all, is it a difficult sell to get somebody to move into at full price a luxury unit next door to somebody who's not paying the full freight and perhaps their unit isn't quite as nicely appointed?
So that was about three questions. Let me see if I can answer it. Is it a difficult sell to get a developer to do it? If a developer is not getting any incentives, mm-hmm. it is more of a difficult sell to get them to do it. In terms of people living next to somebody who is not paying as much rent, that hasn't played out in First Ward. First Ward is one of our most vibrant communities in the city of Charlotte. And so I think there's real learning, there's real value to the community for creating mixed income neighborhoods, not only for the people who are living there, but just creating that homogenous community is really helpful.
What about return on investment? Because obviously developers want to see they have quarterly profits that they have to show to their investors, et cetera. And if developers have difficulty finding a return on investment, that doesn't mean there isn't one to society. So, and we've already talked a little bit about this. So how do we convince people or inform people that there is this long-term overarching benefit to society that would allow us to apply more pressure to both developers and people in neighborhoods that don't want their neighborhood to be mixed?
So you're right.
Another tough question.
That is a tough question. And ironically, that's one of the questions that I have for the panelists tomorrow night. So what you're saying is it's easy to make the social justice argument for mm-hmm. why we need to do mixed income communities, but it's harder to make the return on investment argument. I would argue that, so we go back to schools, we go back to healthcare. If we are creating quality mixed income housing communities, if a kid who might not be as up to speed as a kid with a more stable family can live next to the neighbor. He or she might learn better or have a better study partner if they're living in a mixed income community. You talked about health care. If folks are living in a mixed income community with quality, affordable, and market rate, their overall health outcomes over the long term might be better.
Here's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that stable housing leads to children who have better lives, who can study, who do better in school, whose health problems, both their health problems and the health problems of their parents, decrease, costing us less money. Because if you are in affordable housing or if you're underprivileged, you're going to go to the doctor or the hospital, probably to the emergency room, and it's going to cost the taxpayer money. That all of this improves over time, and it improves probably over the course of about 20 years from the time a child is born to the time they get out of college or get their first job. 20 years for an immediate gratification society in which we live is literally a lifetime. So how do you get people to say, okay, we have to be in this for the long haul? We're going to invest in this today, and we're not going to see any results until 2036.
Well, I think you're going to see small results add up over time. So you'll see the huge cumulative results in 20 years, but every year marking along the path of that, you will see children succeeding better in school. You'll see neighborhoods being stronger, communities being stronger, with affordable housing, stable housing being placed near good transportation options and things like that, people will be able to hold down their jobs. They'll be able to be more active in their community. And I think you'll see little bits of it every year aggregating to the long term.
But you have to convince.
That's right. If I can just jump in briefly.
Sure.
I think definitely there is the 20-year view. And, if you want to change where Charlotte ranks in the those social mobility rankings, that's the view you got to take, because that's the you know, kid growing up and having a career, right? But I think it doesn't have to be that long of a viewpoint either. This study that I was citing, that was a pilot out in Oregon, that was only 4 years. So in 4 years, they were able to demonstrate really big decreases in healthcare spending. So, you know, I think it for some of the more stable families, it'd be a longer time lag. But for the families that are really, really unstable, that switch and that change is going to happen pretty quickly for them. So I think you'll see some of both.
Okay. A lot of people are afraid of affordable housing. They think whether it's a project next door to them or a big apartment complex, or whether it is individual units scattered in amongst the regular price units, they're afraid of it because they're afraid that it will lower their property values. Pamela, you say, the city says, there is no evidence that assisted housing negatively affects property values. No evidence, really. None.
I've not found any evidence.
And are we looking for it?
Well, there are a number of studies out there. I will say that it might not increase your property value, I've not found any studies that says that it brings your property value down. An apartment building is an apartment building. It's built with the same materials as a market rate apartment building is built with. So it's not there. I've not found any studies that says it decreases your property value.
Evidently, Atlanta's Housing Authority has developed a reputation for creating mixed-income communities with some success. What have been the benefits to Atlanta for having done this?
Renee Glover, she's known as these are my words, the first lady of the mixed-income housing movement in Atlanta, East Lake Village. That is one of Atlanta's most well-known mixed-income housing communities. It was a public housing community, was redeveloped as a mixed-income housing community, and kids are exceeding really well there, and there's a school that's a part of that, and it's just done really well in the city of Atlanta.
What about other cities? What are they doing elsewhere where they're doing something particularly well that is helping to solve this problem, that is lifting people out of poverty, that is breaking this cycle where and suddenly kids can succeed in school and parents don't have to worry about Johnny coming home and getting shot in the front yard or having to move out tomorrow because the rent just went up and they can't afford it? What's happening in other cities?
You know, a lot of what's happening in other cities, we're seeing pilots of that going on here in Charlotte too. It's just a matter of trying to get more of it quicker. You know, things like Renaissance West, which is, you know, really doing great things for that redevelopment of that neighborhood. But so what you see in other cities is, you know, a really concentrated effort of intentionally working with developers, working with public government agencies, and working with the nonprofits, and this collaborative effort in developing neighborhoods very intentionally and working to focus resources on those neighborhoods.
Are we doing that?
Yeah, I think that's right, and having a really broad perspective about it. So it is the housing, obviously, but it's also ensuring that there are green spaces and that it's near transport and, you know, that all of those other pieces are there too, because it's wonderful you build a affordable housing unit out on a strip with no access to anything. The people that are living there, great, they can afford it, but if they can't get to a job or get to a school, that's not very helpful. So it's having a more complete vision. I think those collaborations are really, really key. And having a plan. You know, cities that plan are the ones that succeed.
Do we have a plan in Charlotte?
Yes. So what we're working on now is creating a comprehensive housing strategy. But I'll go back to what Stephanie said, and that's really important. In terms of having housing along public transportation, that's really important because
We have this transit-oriented policy, do we not?
We have a transit-oriented development policy, but I'll be specific when I say not only having housing along transit lines, but having affordable housing on transit lines. So if you go back to think about, you shouldn't pay more than 30% of your annual income for housing. We established early in the program that many affordable households do that. So just think about the possibilities. If there's affordable housing along a transit line, you can decrease the amount of time or the amount of money you spend in your vehicle. All that begins to add up, and that speaks to that return on investment over time.
Has that happened in South End along the Blue Line? Is there mixed-use development, or are all those new apartments and condominiums for people who make a decent amount of money.
All of those along the blue line are market rate. There's the one that you read about probably in the newspaper over on Saturday, Brook Hill Village. It has not been developed, but it is some of the worst affordable housing we have in the city.
Well, if we have this transit-oriented policy that calls for development of assisted multifamily housing within a quarter mile of transit stations when part of a mixed-income housing development, these are all the city's words, as we expand light rail to the north, are we going to see that kind of housing, or are we going to see more of the market rate housing, which makes a lot of money for developers and property owners? Are we going to see developers taking advantage of this?
It is my hope, Mike, and desire that we will see more developers taking advantage.
But why would we see that? It's your hope, but why would we see that if clearly it hasn't happened in South End?
Right. So I'm hopeful that we have a city council who is very supportive of affordable housing. They understand the need. They understand where we are as a city. So they're very hopeful. I'm hopeful that as we market the programs and the incentives that we have from the city, that developers will also see the need for it and begin to take advantage of it.
Has anybody in this town, and we only have 30 seconds left, talked about housing vouchers, which are not unlike food stamps? You get a voucher from a municipality that would help you pay for market rate housing. Anybody talked about that here?
Well, the Housing Authority, they have what's known as their Section 8 vouchers.
Yeah. But I mean for market rate housing.
Not as much as needs to. I mean, I think it's a good, viable solution to trying to fill this gap of the lack of affordable housing.
You get the last word because we're out of time. Laura Belcher is the president and CEO of Habitat for Humanity Charlotte. Stephanie Ettinger de Cuba will be here tomorrow as part of the Affordable Housing Building Futures Seminar. She's Research and Policy Director for Children's Health Watch, and Pamela Weidman will be moderating that discussion, Deputy Director of Neighborhood and Business Services and Housing Services Manager for the City of Charlotte. Thank you all for the hour.